Welcome to the Making Sense Podcast. This is Sam Harris. Today I'm speaking with Sebastian Younger. Sebastian is a New York Times bestselling author of several books: Tribe, War, Freedom, A Death in Belmont, Fire, and The Perfect Storm. He was also a co-director on the documentary film Restrepo, which was nominated for an Academy Award. He is the winner of a Peabody Award and the National Magazine Award for Reporting. And his most recent book is In My Time of Dying, How I Came Face to Face with the Idea of an Afterlife. And it is a wonderful book, which is the focus of our discussion. We talk about Sebastian's experience as a journalist in war zones, the connection between danger and meaning, Sebastian's experience of nearly dying from a burst aneurysm in his abdomen, and his lingering trauma, the concept of awe, psychedelics, near-death experiences, atheism, psychic phenomena, consciousness in the brain, and other topics. And I bring you Sebastian Younger. I am here with Sebastian Younger. Sebastian, thanks for joining me.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I've been a huge fan of your work, I think, since The Perfect Storm, which I remember reading in hardcover. I don't when was that, like 97 or something? When did that come out?
Yeah, 97, like a million years ago,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah, that was an amazing read, and I've really enjoyed several of your other books since. And so we're mostly going to focus on your new book, which is In My Time of Dying, How I Came Face to Face with the Idea of an Afterlife, which recounts the time you almost died from a ruptured aneurysm in your pancreatic artery. And you make many excursions into history and physics that are really quite wonderful. But it is a, it's by turns a very funny but also harrowing book. I actually listened to it as an audiobook, and it's a fantastic audiobook. You read it. And I was on a hike for most of it. And at one point, as you're recounting your unfolding medical emergency, which really does read like a thriller, I started to worry, like, wait a minute, this would be all too weird if I were to die from my own ruptured something while listening to this far from, you know, a hospital or any potential rescue. And I actually, at one point, I just decided to head back to civilization. Like, I'm too far from a hospital for this part of the book.
That's very funny, because I had similar fears afterwards. I was very paranoid about being far from medical help.
Yeah, you talk about that. So we'll get to that. I want to let's just track through it systematically. But perhaps before we jump into the book, I mean, you have this history in many of your books and projects of courting danger, and there's a documentary on your time in Afghanistan that called Restrepo that many people will have seen. And you've been in war zones. Your books, Tribe and War, talk about the effect of war and the connection of between danger and meaning. Perhaps just let's talk about your proximity to danger that you have sought out more than most people.
Yeah, well, just to start off by saying, within my population of foreign reporters, that's the norm, and I'm probably at the low end of risk taking and the sort of aggregate of dangerous experiences. So just to be clear, like, I look like a risk taker to the general population, but not to my population.
Right.
So I grew up in a very safe, pretty affluent Boston suburb in the 60s and 70s, and I had this sense, I don't know why, but I had the sense that as a teenager, that if I wasn't somehow tested in some sort of mortal way, that I would never mature into a man. I would just stay forever sort of juvenile. And I knew that in this suburb, nothing was ever going to, nothing was really ever going to test me. There were no volcanoes. There were no hurricanes. No rebels were going to come driving down the street and pick up trucks. There would be no way to sort of prove my worth to society, which throughout history, young men have felt compelled to do. And the society needed them to do that. And I don't know why I was aware of this, but I was. And, eventually, my father was a refugee from two wars. He was born in Germany, but he grew up in Spain, and he and his family left Spain when the fascists came in 1936 with Franco, and they went to Paris. His father was Jewish. When the Nazis came in, they fled to the United States. And so war was sort of in the background of my family's history. And in my early 30s, I'd worked for some years as a climber for tree companies, taking trees down. So way up in the air on a rope with a chainsaw, and I'd actually gotten hurt doing that. But in the early 90s, there was a civil war in Bosnia. And I just thought, I'm 32, I need to do something that demonstrates something worthy about myself. And I went to Sarajevo and I sort of turned myself into a war reporter. And then I kept doing it, despite having to occasionally write books.
Yeah, so I forgot about that in your history. So were you on camera for CNN or anything like that, or were you just writing?
No, yeah. God, if only. So I was like plankton in the food chain of foreign reporters in Sarajevo, right? I mean, I was like an occasional freelance radio correspondent. I would basically phone in 30-second, 40-second voice spots into ABC right. Radio and what have you, Deutsche Welle. And, you know, it was very much just a sort of initiatory process. I mean, I learned how to do that work, but I didn't come close to earning anything close to a living doing it. But it was like going to journalism school. Mm-hmm. And I was in a war, and I was with other freelancers. And I learned something really, really valuable about war, about humans, about myself. I came back feeling very, very different and really sort of in love with the idea of a job that had enormous meaning. I was reporting on reporting on world events, on things that were happening in front of me, tragic things, important things, and communicating that back to a population in the United States. And that to me, the sort of role of the messenger in society, that to me was like just absolutely intoxicating.
Mm. What is it that you think connects the experience of danger and meaning?
Well, for me, consequences create meaning. So if you're in a situation where you could get killed, there's an enormous amount of meaning around the idea of not making a mistake, of making the right decisions, of relying on other people and they rely on you and you all come out of it okay. There's an enormous amount of meaning that comes with that danger. And the problem with things that are free of danger, and listen, we're blessed if we have those things, right? I mean, many people in the world don't. But the problem with, say, a round of golf is that it might be fun, it might be pleasurable, it might be relaxing, but it actually has very little sort of meaning. And what I found in the safe little suburb that I was growing up in was I was sort of desperate for meaning. And sometimes war reporters are called sort of adrenaline junkies or whatever. And what I think was going on more for me and for most of the other people that I knew, men and women both, in those situations, is that there was more like they were meaning junkies. Like they wanted to be living lives where things had huge consequences, an enormous amount of meaning. And that's actually the thing you sort of get addicted to. Mm. It's not, you know, frankly, sprinting across the street while a sniper's trying to shoot you is not particularly addictive.
So is it the social component to it that you're, because it's something you emphasize in Tribe, that the bonding that occurs between soldiers and people in conflict zones, or is it, can you imagine, or have you experienced the same kind of ramping up of consequences, but in solitude, delivering the same sort of meaning?
Well, I imagine Alex Hanold, the free soloist, who, if I said his name correctly, anyway, I think we know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, his amygdala is malfunctioning, and he can free solo El Cap without apparently breaking a sweat.
No, that's definitely a solo activity, and there's definitely a huge amount of meaning to it for him and for anyone understanding what he's doing. So it doesn't have to be with other people, but consequences sort of sharpen the contours of reality, and he's obviously dealing with enormous consequences when he does his work on those cliffs. But for most humans, I don't know if he's human or not, but for most human beings—
He's barely human. I've never met him, but judging from what I've seen, he is a far, far outlier of something.
Yeah. Yeah, and seems to be an extraordinarily nice guy. Yeah. Anyway, for most humans, hardship and risk and danger and trauma are generally faced in a group. And that's been true for hundreds of thousands of years. And, you know, war is no different. And even if you're a war reporter and you're in, say, Sierra Leone in the late 90s like I was, or Liberia in 2003, or Bosnia in the early 90s, whatever it may be, an American platoon in combat in eastern Afghanistan, as I was in 07, 08, you end up inevitably in sort of these social groups, sort of survival groups, as it were. And the relationship between the individual and the group that they find themselves dependent on for survival is very, very intense. And the deal seems to be that if you are willing to be sort of selfless and altruistic on behalf of the welfare of the group then takes you in and you're welcomed into it and you're sort of honored in some way. And, you know, what I saw in Sarajevo was really interesting. And I immediately wanted to sort of be part of it. I almost had the totally self-indulgent thought, wow, those people are lucky that they get this. And what I was seeing was that every neighborhood had its sort of local defense group. And these were like young men, typically, that were using an assortment of, you know, hunting rifles and AK-47s and what have you. And they dug trenches and they were defending the city of Sarajevo neighborhood by neighborhood in very, very local groups. And they were living a kind of communal life on a front line. And it looked so tribal. Mm. And these young people, and the women as well, because they had a very important role as well, these young people were such a totally necessary, vital part of their own community and its survival. I just thought, like, that's life. Like, that's what life's supposed to be, something like that. And again, a self-indulgent thought, because there was a huge amount of suffering. You know, 1 out of 5 civilians was wounded or killed in that city over the 3 years of the siege by the besieging Bosnian Serb forces. I mean, just absolutely grotesque. But, you know, I think we can still say in sort of human terms, they had a core human experience that's typified human life for a very, very long time. And the pity, along with the huge blessings and benefits of modern, safe, affluent modern society, the pity of it is that we, particularly young people, get sort of deprived of being in a role of importance and urgency like that.
Well, how do you make sense of the fact that these experiences, which seem objectively bad and worth avoiding, I mean, they're just the chaos of war, right, can deliver to those who survive and, you know, scathed or unscathed, I would imagine, some of the most meaningful experiences, perhaps the most meaningful experiences they've ever had in life. And we know from, again, this is something you focus on more in your books. I think it might be both tribe and war, but this experience that, you know, it's very common for soldiers to return from a war and find, you know, normal life and the safety therein really denuded of meaning. And it's, you know, on some level they're, you could write this off as that, you know, they're essentially adrenaline junkies. I mean, they've just played the highest stakes video game ever and nothing else compares, but yeah, there are probably deeper layers to it than that. But what seems paradoxical about it is that the kind of lives that we put a tremendous amount of energy and attention in seeking to maintain, which is to say lives that are quite protected from danger and chaos. And this is these are the kinds of lives we wish upon those we love and our children, you know, especially.
Yeah.
And yet you keep noticing that it's in extremis that so many people find the juicy goodness of actually being slammed into a full encounter with their own existence.
Well, I think there's two things going on. First of all, survival is meaningful. I mean, just in basic Darwinian terms, right? Like, if we didn't value survival, we wouldn't be here. And the behaviors that help our survival, the evolutionary process, has made gratifying or pleasurable. So if you're hungry, eating is an important thing to do, and it feels good. Sex feels good, right? Archery feels good if you hit the bullseye and you get a little bump of dopamine, right? So all of these behaviors that help us survive and master our circumstances are rewarded with some kind of good feeling. And one of the good feelings that we have is, you know, topping out on the, you know, top of El Capitan or whatever. It's like, you know, winning, succeeding, like overcoming the monster, the beast, you know, like vanquishing. And the other one, and they're very tied together, is human connection, right? That's also, it's the other, along with survival, is the other exceedingly meaningful thing that we do. And after my book Tribe came out, there was some, I can't remember where it was, a comment, it might have been on Amazon or something. I can't quite remember, but it was a young woman whose sister tragically had died of cancer, I think. And she talked about how during those last days of her sister's life while her sister was dying that she missed those days because everyone came in, the cousins and the friends and the family, and it was just this gathering of forces. And there was something, as she said, as tragic as it was, she missed it because it felt real. And she was connected to so many people in this vital way. And if you look at history, you know, the tragedies, the catastrophes that hit human society, the Blitz in London, all right? The German Air Force bombed London and other English cities night after night for 6 months. They killed 30,000 civilians, right? There were civilians digging civilians out of the rubble and injecting the ones they couldn't save with morphine so they could, you know, die painlessly. And everyone was sleeping and, you know, in the subways and rationing food. And I mean, just a nightmare, right? And what happened afterwards? Londoners said that they missed it. And the ghastly class system in England sort of broke down during those days. I mean, if you're sleeping shoulder to shoulder with other people in a tube station, it doesn't really matter if you're, quote, upper class or, quote, lower class, right? And not only that, but the catastrophe, the crisis seemed to promote sort of psychological well-being. The government was prepared for mass psychiatric casualties during the bombings, right? Of course they were. And it turns out that admissions to psych wards went down during the bombings and then back up after the bombings stopped. And after Hurricane Katrina, there was a similar thing along the Mississippi coast. I have friends who live down there. He said people really missed the time of sort of community effort and bonding that happened in the wake of that terrible hurricane. So yes, it seems sort of odd that these catastrophes elicit such fond feelings, but they give people a purpose, a meaning. That is survival, and they bring people together. And those are the things that make humans happy. You know, we're social primates, like, you know, we're adapted for that.
Is there anything you have done differently in your life, born of having understood this, again, somewhat paradoxical lesson of how attention and bonding get sharpened up in extremis in this way? I mean, can you graft this on in a more orderly, less death-defying way than perhaps Alex Honnold is managing it?
And, right.
And again, we'll get to your encounter with the actual abyss pretty soon. But prior to that, did you consciously change your life in response to what you were learning when you were researching tribe and war?
Yeah. So after I came back from a year off and on with a platoon in combat, with American forces in combat in eastern Afghanistan, I made a documentary called Restrepo with my buddy Tim Hetherington. And I came back from there, and the guys that I'd been with were, I was quite surprised. Like, this was a hellish hilltop, right? There were, like, it was all men. We were getting shot at just about every day. There was no communication with the outside world. There was no internet. There was no way to call your girlfriend. There was no, for the first 3 months, there wasn't even electricity. They didn't even have a generator, right? They were sleeping in the dirt with the tarantulas and the scorpions and et cetera. And they spent 15 months up there. And so they finally got brought back to Italy and all the pleasures and delights of civilization. And you can imagine what that looked like for a while. But then the party sort of died down. And a lot of them said they wanted to go back. They couldn't deal. They wanted to go back to Restrepo. A lot of them said that. And I remember I had I was very fortunate to have a surrogate uncle named Ellis, who I've written about, and he was part Apache, part Sioux, I believe. At any rate, he was Native American. He was born out west in the late 1920s and an incredibly learned man and extraordinary man. And I remember him, sorry, I'm going to have to be a little improper here, but, and this is his language, but I remember him saying to me, Sebastian, all throughout the history of the United States, from the earliest days on, he said, you white people were always running off to join us Indians, to join the tribes. And he said, we Indians never ran off to join white society, to, you know, plow fields and go to church on Sundays and all that stuff. It is always towards the tribal. And I, you know, in my mind, I'm like, oh, right, yeah, okay, right. You know, I didn't know if Ellis was sort of selling me a bill of goods or whatever. And then when I was trying to understand the soldiers, I thought, oh my God, maybe Ellis was right. Maybe that's true. Maybe what these guys miss is that tribal component of, like, we're all equal, we're all together, we need each other, we're in the fight together. Like, maybe that's actually what's intoxicating. And you come back to safe America, and yeah, of course, it's great to not get shot at anymore, et cetera, et cetera. And again, we're blessed to live in those circumstances, but there is a real human loss. I mean, the more affluent and safe you are, the less you need other people to survive, and then you end up without human connection, which is the ultimate, I mean, human connection is the ultimate drug, right? I mean, the ultimate thing that makes you feel good. Again, we're social primates. Humans don't survive by themselves in the wilderness. They die almost immediately. We survive in groups. And we have a lot of sort of neurochemical reinforcement of those oxytocin and all these other hormones that allow us to, that make us feel good when we're collaborating in a group. And so I realized that, you know, Ellis was right. And I looked back into the history books and indeed along the frontier, the Pennsylvania frontier where my ancestors settled in the 1780s, all the way on up through the Midwest into the West and the Southwest, young men and sometimes young women would run off and join the native culture, or even if they native society, and even if they'd been kidnapped during raids, if often they didn't want to go home, they didn't want to go back, right? They wanted to stay, quote, Indian. And so that to me suddenly made sense of this thing. So how do you live your life in a, I live in America, it's a modern affluent country, right? It's a highly mechanized, industrialized country. How do you live in such a place? And to your question, keep some, what decisions can you make to keep some sort of tribal feeling? And so, you know, what I would say, first of all, is, I mean, I grew up in a, you know, pretty affluent suburb, and I've just made it a point in my life. They're extremely alienating places, and I've just made it a point in my life to never do that. And so I live in a very much a mixed income, mixed race, Lower East Side, in the New York's Lower East Side community, which is sort of small enough and human enough that, you know, people recognize each other, we need each other. There's all kinds of sort of street level collaboration, and it feels very, very communal and good. And the building that I live in with my wife and two little girls, before I was in there during Hurricane Sandy, there was an extraordinary example of this sort of communality that you would get in a poor neighborhood, and I think not in a rich one. Hurricane Sandy shut off the lights, and, you know, in New York City from 34th Street and below. So at nighttime, it was, you know, quite frightening in Manhattan, actually, gangs of young men roaming around and all kinds of sort of quasi-apocalyptic feeling scenes, right? So in this particular building, it's a tenement building and mostly Spanish-speaking and a lot of interrelatedness between the apartments, cousins and uncles and what have you. One of the mothers, Dominican or Puerto Rican, I'm not sure which, got a machete because they were worried about break-ins, because a lot of the people who had children had to leave the building because there was no water. There was no running water. So the people with young children left the building. So there's empty apartments. They're worried about break-ins, right? Mm-hmm. So
you had your own Restrepo on 34th Street. You could just add some tarantulas and scorpions and you're good to go.
That's right. So she got a machete and she got a bunch of teenage boys and young men and gave them a sort of guard roster. And so there was a young man with a machete in front of the, you know, in front of the door 24/7 until the lights went back on. Now that's community, right? Like that's the fabric of human society. And so, you know, one of the decisions I made was just not live in affluence and not live in suburbia.
Okay, so let's talk about how you can't quite escape death or near death even in the pristine surroundings. You weren't in the city when this went down. You were outside of it. So let's walk me through your medical emergency, and then we'll get into the more ethereal topics that surface for you.
Yeah. So I'll back up a few years. After being a war reporter for many years and having had many close calls, I was blown up by an IED, had a bullet hit next to my forehead into a sandbag, etc. My colleague, my brother, my friend, Tim Hetherington, who I made Restrepo with, was killed in Libya. He caught a mortar fragment in his groin and he bled out in the back of a rebel pickup truck looking at the blue Libyan sky as he raced to the Misrata hospital. He got there a few minutes too late. And so I got out of the war business at that point. I didn't want to devastate all of the people who loved me like I had just watched Tim do to everyone who loved him.
And did you have your daughters at that point?
No, I didn't. I didn't. I was in my first marriage, and that I had a lot of psychological struggles after Restrepo and after Tim was killed, and among other things, it contributed to costing me my marriage. But you know, then things got better again. I got together with Barbara, my wife, and we had a family, and everything was amazing, right? And I never looked back. Mm. Now at this point, I have a family, and they're my absolute priority. And so, and then COVID hits. And so when COVID hits, we have a newborn and a almost three-year-old. And COVID hits, and we are lucky again. You know, I'm an extremely lucky person, and we had the choice of leaving New York, this little apartment. We live in a tiny apartment, and we co-sleep. It's like 500 square feet, and it's like we're camping in an apartment, right? I mean, it's really small. The idea of going through COVID in that with, you know, two young kids just seemed really tough. And we own property in Massachusetts in the woods, an old, old house in the woods at the end of a dead-end dirt road. And it was a no-brainer, right? So we moved in there, and it was in June of 2020. I don't think in terms of medical emergency, because I'm a lifelong athlete. I was a really good distance runner when I was young. I've got an athlete's heart. I'm not a walking, you know, my heart's not a, you know, ticking time bomb. I'm not going to have a stroke. I mean, all these things that drop middle-aged men in their tracks. Mm. I just don't have those worries, right? So I just never thought I would have to rush to the hospital for anything. And so in this house, there's no cell phone service. It's a long dirt road through the woods to get there, and sometimes impassable. And the phone lines the landline doesn't work when it rains because the lines are old and they short out. So that's the context for what's about to happen now. So it's June 16th, 2020. And we had a little bit of babysitting from some teenage girls who live down the road. And they came in to take care of our six-month-old and our three-year-old. And I'd built a cabin sort of even deeper in the woods, just like oil lamps and wood stove, like a really primitive place. And my wife and I went out, Barbara and I went out there to just chill out for a little bit. And very beautiful spot. And in mid-sentence, I felt this jolt of pain in my abdomen. And I was like, ooh, what is that? You know, it was like incredibly bad indigestion, right? Mm. I didn't know what it was. It was burning. And I sort of stood up to try to walk it out. And I almost fell over. And I mean, the floor just went reeling away from me. And I sat back down and I said words I never thought I'd ever say. I said, I'm going to need help. I've never felt anything like this. And so Barbara sort of half dragged me out of the woods and sort of keeping me upright and my arm around her shoulders and got me to the driveway and put me in the passenger seat of the car and then ran in and told the girls, like whispered to the babysitters, you know, Sebastian has to go to the hospital. Something's really wrong. So one of the phone lines weren't working. Nothing was working. One of the girls managed to get one bar of cell phone connection on her cell phone and called 911. And so I didn't know this, but I had an undiagnosed aneurysm, a sort of ballooning of the blood vessel in one of my pancreatic arteries. It's extremely rare. And it's not, you know, it's a random defect, right? It's not high cholesterol or what have you, clogged arteries. It really is sort of a random freakish thing. And aneurysms are deadly because they have no symptoms. And if they rupture, the mortality rate is incredibly high. It's very hard to fix that. And people just bleed out into their own abdomen, which is what I was doing. I was losing a pint of blood every 10 or 15 minutes. And so my blood pressure was just tanking. So I'm in the car and I'm in and out of consciousness and I start going blind, all symptoms of blood loss, extreme blood loss. And I'm basically a human hourglass. And the hospital is an hour drive away. And the odds would have been long if the hospital had been 5 minutes away, right? And it's an hour. And I hung on. They put me in the ambulance. They didn't know what was wrong. They didn't think it was particularly serious, but we went to the hospital and right when I sort of kept it together, something called compensatory shock, where your body shuts down all unnecessary blood flow to your limbs, et cetera, to your skin, and pools it where it's needed in your chest and your brain. Your body can do that for like an hour or so, and then it can't do it anymore. And that's what happened as soon as we pulled up to the ER. I went from compensatory shock into end-stage hemorrhagic shock. I was convulsing and totally disoriented. And the doctors knew immediately what was happening, and they rushed me into the trauma bay. And a doctor started getting ready to insert a large gauge needle through my neck straight into my jugular to transfuse me, which is actually I mean, it sounds horrifying, but it didn't hurt at all. I don't know why.
This might have been the point where I turned around on my hike, so.
Right. Well, and, you know, I had no idea I was dying, right? Yeah. And the doctor said to me, do I have permission to do this procedure? And I, you know, it didn't sound very fun. I said, you mean in case there's an emergency?
Yeah.
And he said, sir, this is the emergency right now.
So you're pretty much in the middle of the emergency.
Yeah. And I had no, you know, I had no idea. And so, you know, I should say right now, so people don't get the wrong idea, I'm an atheist. I'm a stone cold atheist. My father was a physicist. He was an atheist. I'm not a mystic. I'm not spiritual. I don't think coincidences mean anything. I don't think things are meant to be or not meant to be. Like, I don't believe in anything, right? And so while the doctor is working on my neck, trying to get the needle in there, which takes a little while, I suddenly become aware of this black pit that has opened up underneath me, slightly to my left, and I'm getting pulled into it. And it's sort of infinitely, infinitely black and infinitely deep. Mm. And it's eternity.
When you say, so the description that you're now giving suggests a visual experience, but is it more just, how are you locating it in space if it's not something you're seeing with your open eyes?
I, good question, and I don't know. I sensed it. I just became aware that there was a pit to my left below me, and that I was getting pulled into this darkness. And it was a final darkness. And again, I didn't know I was dying, but I had the sense, like, you go in there, you are not coming back out. And I was panicking. And then my dead father appeared above me and to my left.
And when you what do you think, your eyes were closed at this point, or your eyes open?
They were open. I mean, I was still talking to the doctors, but I was also, you know, it was like I was incredibly drunk. Like my mind was not working right. And I was in and out of consciousness. And I wouldn't say, it's not like I saw him on the ceiling like a cardboard cutout of my father. I mean, it wasn't that tangible.
Mm.
But he was there in a sort of energy form. I mean, there aren't even really words to precisely say what it was I was seeing or feeling, but I was startled. I was startled to see him. I'm like, my dad? Like, what are you doing up there? He'd been dead 8 years, and he was a physicist. He was definitely, I found out, you know, realized later in my life, on the spectrum, a very sweet man, but not hard to be close to, emotionally close to. That was my relationship with him. And suddenly there he was. And he was communicating to me, it's okay. You don't have to fight it. Like, I'll take care of you. You can come with me. And my reaction was horror. I mean, I didn't know I was dying. So when he said, come with you, I'm like, you're dead. I'm not going anywhere with you. We have nothing in common. Like, it was, the suggestion was grotesque. And I said to the doctor, you have to hurry. I'm going right now. You're losing me. And I didn't know I was dying, but I knew I was going away. And I was going away towards something that was completely terrifying and horrifying. And so I was sort of warned the doctor, like, Doc, hurry it up with that needle.
Mm. And is your sense that you were, when you're talking to the doctors at this point, were you making sense, or did you just thought you were making sense? I mean, were you producing intelligible utterances that they were responding to, or were you just jabbering?
Well, yeah, no, I mean, I think I was being intelligible. I mean, when he asked me, I mean, this was moments earlier, do I have permission to put a needle?
Right.
You know, I said, in case there's an emergency, I was able to give my phone number at the house so that they could call my wife. You know, I mean, so my brain was functioning, but I was seeing things. I was either hallucinating or I was seeing things that people can't see in an ordinary state of mind. You know, take your pick. I don't know which it is. And then we can get to that. And then, so they transfused me. They put 3 units into me. I was 60 over 40 when I got to the ER, which is, you know, a rock bottom blood pressure. In the end, I needed 10 units of blood. The mortality rate for what I had is as high as 70% if you get to the hospital quickly. It took me an hour. So, you know, I just threaded the needle. And luckily, I was healthy and, you know, strong. And I gave the doctor something to work with. They took me to the IR suite. And that's interventional radiology suite. And they put me on a fluoroscope, which is basically an X-ray machine that takes video sort of in real time. So doctors can do things to you and watch in real time as the catheter they're threading up your femoral artery. They can watch it, you know, progress through your abdomen like it's a sort of a miracle machine. But it gives you a lot of radiation. And I was on the thing for so long that I got radiation burns on my back. Mm. Like 2 weeks later, I got this red square appeared on my back, and that was from radiation, which really upset my wife. And I tried to make her feel better by joking about it. I said, it's okay, we can call it Square Noble. And she was like, that's not funny. So I was in there. It wasn't surgery. They didn't cut me open. They put a catheter into my groin, in my femoral, and started trying to reach the site of the bleed within my vascular system. And they couldn't do it. And the alternative was an emergency laparotomy, which I probably would not have survived. That would be a sort of last ditch thing where they just open up your stomach and start looking for the bleed before you bleed out. And, you know, your abdomen's basically a huge bowl of spaghetti, and trying to find the bleed in that is like extremely hard. And so their best chance was to use a catheter, and for some reason they couldn't get it to the spot. And I have a very weird vasculature apparently, and they couldn't sort of navigate all the twists and turns. And I remember, you know, hours into this, and I'm conscious, I'm not sedated because my vitals are so low, and I'm in incredible pain. And I watched one of the doctors sort of shrug and sort of give up. He was like, "We've tried everything. Like we're you know, there's nothing more we can do." And I watched he said that, gave the other doctor that look, like, "We tried." And that was the first moment where I realized what the stakes were. That the stakes were my survival. I didn't realize until then. It was absolutely terrifying. And then the other doctor said, "Why don't we try going through his left wrist, which would allow for a different approach?" And the first doctor said, "I like the way you think." And then they went back to work on me. And eventually they fixed it. They saved my life. And I woke up in the ICU. I think they said, as soon as they coiled the leak, they embolized the leak. And so that stopped the blood loss. And I think they sedated me and, you know, just put me down. And I woke up in the ICU the next morning. And, you know, I woke up without any idea that I'd almost died. And I didn't know that until an ICU nurse came in. Sort of middle-aged lady, wonderful woman, tough. She sort of seemed like she'd buried three husbands, like totally tough, pragmatic lady with a really heavy Boston accent. And she came in and said, "How you doing, Mr. Younger? You know, congratulations. We almost lost you last night. It was a miracle. No one can believe you survived." And immediately I remembered my father. I was like, "Oh my God, I saw my father. What was he doing there in the pit?" It all came back to me. And then she left, and I was just lying there with this shocking news, like, I almost died. I came in with belly pain and I almost died. My daughters, my wife, like, I mean, it was horrifying. And she came and I was throwing up blood. I was a mess. I mean, physically, I was like really a hurting puppy. And the nurse came back an hour later and said, "Hey, how are you doing?" And I said, "Well, you know, what you told me is terrifying. Like, I can't believe I almost died." And she said, "Instead of thinking about it like something scary, try thinking about it like something sacred." And she walked out. And so for me, again, I'm an atheist, but sacred is a very fine word, and I use it all the time. And what I mean by sacred has nothing to do with God. It has to do with this, for me, this sort of essential meaning that the word has, which is something sacred is something that allows people to live their lives with more dignity, with less fear, with more courage, with more connection, human connection, with more love, like that. So a sacred task, a sacred job would be anything that helps people do that. And it might be a shrink, it might be a minister, it might be a journalist, it might be whatever. I mean, you know it when you see it. And so I thought, I've been going to front lines my whole life. I went to the ultimate front line, which is my own death. And I peered over the edge and I was allowed to come back. Like, did I come back with sacred knowledge, knowledge that could help other people and myself in this sort of sometimes terrifying endeavor called life? Like, what did I come back with? And that set my mind in motion in terms of how I could possibly write a book about this great mystery that I experienced and that, you know, we'll all experience.
Yeah. At the end of the book, you discuss the etymology of the word awe and, point out that its original meaning really was entirely collapsed onto the concepts of dread and terror and fear. And I looked this up in the OED after I heard you say that in the audiobook. And it was only a few hundred years later that the term awe acquired the connotations that we tend to give it now with, you know, the kind of positively valenced emotions of reverence and wonder, right? So it's interesting, this the two facets of this concept of awe, the kind of the dread and wonder sides of it.
Yeah, and then there's this sort of ghastly modern usage of awesome, so which is not what we're talking about. Yeah, awe has this sort of thread of fear and dread running through it, which is entirely appropriate. I mean, you can't think about the universe, about life, about death, without some uncomfortable feelings, right? It's just not a nice squishy feeling, right? There's definitely fear, along with love and reverence. I mean, it's sort of everything. I find that etymology can be really helpful in clarifying something. And at one point, when I came home from the hospital, I had a lot of psychological problems. I had a paranoia that I could die at any moment. Like at any morning, I could just die. And it made me extremely anxious. And I also had this fear. I had this fear that I had died and that I was a ghost. I was a spirit. And that I didn't know that, you know, I was sort of imagining that my children were reacting to me, but actually that they couldn't see me, that I wasn't there. And it was deeply frightening, a deeply frightening feeling. And I had that, if I can digress for a moment, I had that for a very specific reason. One night before almost dying, I had a dream that I did die. And the dream was this, that I was hovering above my family, and they were in grief. They were crying. And I was hovering above them, and I didn't know I was a spirit, but I didn't know it. And I was trying to communicate with them. I was waving and I was shouting, and they couldn't hear me. They couldn't see me. And then I was made to understand, no, you died. You can't go back. This is it. Like, say goodbye. You're leaving. And I was so anguished that it woke me up. And I woke up next to my eldest daughter. We co-sleep, and there she was. I sort of put my arms around her, just like in relief, like, oh, thank God, that was just a dream. And then what I found out later, you know, 36 hours later, I am dying, right? Mm-hmm. And so when I came home from the hospital, I started researching near-death experiences, NDEs. And to my puzzlement, many of them, like a huge percentage of them, involve exactly that, that the person, as they were dying, felt that they were hovering above their loved ones or above the hospital bed. Mm-hmm. And then no one could hear them, no one could see them, and they were above them. And so that gave me this paranoid idea that maybe the dream was actually my experience of actually dying. And then everything that followed, going to the hospital, coming back from the hospital, wow, that was a close call, was actually a dying hallucination, and that I wasn't really here. And once I was seized with that terror, it was very hard to shake off. And I really struggled. And at one point, my wife said to me, do you feel lucky or unlucky that you had this experience? I mean, not that I survived, but the whole thing, if you could push a button and have none of it happen, would you push that button? No sacred experience, none of that stuff, just like get it out of here, like just never happen. Would you do that? And I didn't know how to answer. You know, was I lucky or unlucky? Was I blessed or cursed? So a couple of years later, still unable to answer that question and still really struggling with the psychological effects of almost dying, which were frankly way worse than anything I came home from combat with, way worse. I looked up the word blessing. I thought maybe that would sort of help me. And it's derived from the Anglo-Saxon word for blood, which is bledsian. And the idea was that there is no blessing without a wound, that there's no blessing without the shedding of blood in some form, even ritual form. This may go back to the animal sacrifices of pre-Christian Europe. I mean, there's all kinds of theories, but the idea of a wound and a blessing are paired, they're twinned. And as I say in the book, there's no blessing without a wound. Maybe there's also no wound without a blessing. You just have to look for it. And then once I thought about the word blessing in that context, suddenly I was sort of okay with it. I was like, okay, that makes sense to me. And it sort of calmed me down and gave me a framework for understanding what had happened to me.
How are you now in terms of that kind of paranoid hangover, where you're more sensitized to the ever-present prospect of dying?
I'm much better now. It's 4 years ago, and as with combat trauma, you know, humans are resilient. We're designed to survive, and we get over hard things, you know, the death of a spouse, you know, whatever. Like, I mean, you can recover, right? You're never the same, but you can recover. And I did. And I also, at my wife's request, as she said, honey, you're getting to be a little hard to live with.
We need a little more death denial in this marriage.
Yeah, exactly. She asked me to go, you know, get some help. And so I found a wonderful, wonderful therapist who I, you know, really like helped me enormously and sort of helped me dig my way back out of the hole. Climb out of the hole. You don't dig your way out of a hole, do you? But I also, and this is where the sort of blessing part comes in, I had this awareness of the preciousness of life. And if you're too aware of it, it's paralyzing, right? It becomes a curse. And if you're not aware at all of what a blessing it is, and you're just busy scrolling through TikTok, like, sorry, you're losing out, man. You're wasting something. You know, like, that's not the path either. And I've tried to find this sort of middle ground where I can function in a non-neurotic way, but am filled with a kind of awe and reverence. And again, I'm doing this as an atheist. You know, I mean, I think there's a kind of procedural shortcut that you can take via, you know, religion, via the church, but, you know, that's not how I can do it. And I came across this amazing anecdote about Dostoevsky, the Russian writer. This was after I'd finished the book. I didn't know that he was almost executed when he was in his 20s. He belonged to a sort of political group called the Petrashevsky Circle, and they talked about things like liberating the serfs and things like that. That was kind of a no-no in the Tsar's Russia in the 1840s. And he and his buddies, like six of them or so, were rounded up by the Tsar's police and put in prison, and they spent 8 months in prison. And, you know, it was a relatively minor crime, right? So when they finally were released and put in a carriage, they just thought they were being returned to their families. And instead they were driven to a city square and tied to posts. And a firing squad was lined up in front of them, and the men charged their rifles and aimed them, waiting for the command to fire. And Dostoevsky, through a character in a novel, I mean, it's assumed by scholars to be Dostoevsky talking about his own experience through a fictional character. He said that he saw light glinting off a church steeple, and he thought to himself, you know, in moments, I'm going to become part of the sunlight. I'll be part of everything. And that if somehow I should survive this, I'll turn every moment into an infinity. And just then, a rider galloped into the square and said, "The Tsar forgives them." And they weren't shot. Two of the men were insane for the rest of their lives. Dostoevsky went deep, right? I mean, he managed to keep his psyche intact, and he used what he learned in the rest of his life. And so I had this thought, like, none of us know that this isn't the last day of our lives. You don't know, I don't know, no one knows. It could be. For every single one of us, it could be the last day of our lives. And if you somehow knew that, right, that they're going to shoot you tomorrow at dawn, who do you want to be on your last day? What values do you want to represent? Like, what kind of person do you want to be? And that's how you should live, because you don't know. You'll never know. This could be it. Today could be it. So, do you really want to spend a third of it on your phone? Probably not. Do you want to be vengeful and nasty and hold a grudge? You know, like, probably not. Do you want to connect to people you love and communicate how much they mean to you? And do you want to look around with reverence at everything, the trees, the sunlight glinting off the roof? That's probably who you want to be. And what's interesting is that if you take that, the sort of dead man walking experience, if you take that, those actually, you know, they're pretty close to the pro-social behaviors that could save our country, our society, our climate, our world, if we all sort of did them all the time, right? And we don't. We're humans. We're, you know, whatever. We're flawed, and we have all kinds of good and bad traits. But it just, just for the sake of argument, if you take the reverence for life that one might have on one's last day and try to live that way, and we all did that, we're going to be all right. I just don't think it's humanly possible, but I've been given a little glimpse of what Dostoevsky was given, and it, like him, it changed me forever.
So as you were talking, I was reflecting on Nietzsche's notion of eternal recurrence, which I think it's still debated how much he actually believed that this was just metaphysically our situation, but as a thought experiment, just imagine how you would want to live if you thought you would repeat this life an infinite number of times, right? And repeat this same day an infinite number of times.
Right.
And it sort of brings you to the same place. I mean, it's like, yeah. Are you going to be shot at dawn or are you going to repeat this day a trillion times? They both deliver the same lesson that you want to maximize all of those pro-social and wise attitudes that you just indicated. You know, you don't want to be petty. You don't want to be distracted by bullshit. You don't want to be harboring grudges, etc.
Yeah.
Do you have any experience with psychedelics? Has that been part of your life journey?
No, I don't.
Mm.
I had when I was a teenager, 15 or so, I smoked pot a couple of times, one does. I thought it was kind of goofy and funny and not whatever. Didn't think about it much. And then I had, sort of by accident, I had a couple of puffs from a joint that I think had angel dust in it. It had something in it.
Mm.
And I was just, it was an unbelievably terrifying experience. I was way too young. I was totally inexperienced with drugs. And it just terrified me. And after that, being high was just like, in any way, in any form, was just, I just wasn't interested. And so I never did drugs my entire life because of that one experience when I was 15.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah. Well, because it's obviously a fair amount of convergence between certain drug states and the reported phenomenology of near-death experiences, NDEs. And to come back to yours, you didn't, during your medical emergency, have an experience of leaving your body and hovering over the scene. That was the dream you had some days before, right?
That's right. Yeah. And to be clear, my heart didn't stop. I didn't die.
Right.
Right. I mean, my body was getting ready to. I mean, the doctor said I probably had another 10 minutes in me.
Yeah.
But I didn't die. And so I don't know what, you know, 10 minutes later, I might have thrown my arms around my father and, you know, said, so good to see you. Where are we going? You know, I mean, like, I don't know. But, I definitely wasn't ready at that point to go anywhere.
Yeah. So you came into this experience an atheist, and it sounds like you still are. Is there any change in your view of the universe, or what seems plausible to you, or how you weight the various probabilities of certain things being true?
Yeah, so definitely there's been a change. I mean, now, I'm an atheist, which means I don't believe in God, right? Mm. And sometimes people, particularly believers, are like, whoa, so you're still an atheist? Like, you know, you saw your dead father, and my answer is like, look, I saw my dad. I didn't see God. I saw my dad. And the truth is, and I don't know why people they sort of conflate these two things, a quote, afterlife and God. They're not the same thing.
Yeah.
So you could have a creator God that created the universe, right? Whatever that even means, who created a universe that contains biological beings that when they die, they're completely dead. There is no post-death existence of any sort for these creatures. Or you could have a universe that was created through completely mechanical means, right? Like a massive quantum fluctuation, some of the other theories of how something could come from nothing to create this universe, a purely mechanistic universe, where there actually is some kind of post-death existence that at that sort of like subatomic, like quantum level in some way that we don't understand, like that's also possible. So you could have a God and an afterlife, or no God and an afterlife, or God and no afterlife. They don't require each other. You could have both or either or neither.
Yeah.
I would
add that the phenomenology of the near-death experience, even if you wanted to give it a religious interpretation, it works for the Abrahamic expectation and for various Eastern pictures of, you know, karma and rebirth that are quite a bit different, that don't entail, they entail life before life and life after death, but they don't entail the same kind of pattern of redemption and going to heaven or hell that, you know, under the supervision of the Abrahamic God. I mean, it's just a very different picture of survival of death and a very different logic to it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I was very, very careful. I always wince at the word afterlife, and I was very careful in my subtitle, which is how I came face to face with the idea of an afterlife, which I definitely did. I mean, I was confronted with the idea of it. How could I not be? Obviously, I would never claim to have found one. So the last talk that I gave a few days ago in Pittsburgh, the last person who asked a question from the audience was quite upset because I said I'm an atheist and I, you know, whatever. And he, you know, he's quite angry, actually. He said, did you ever consider for a moment that you only survived because of God's mercy, God's grace, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm try thinking about it like that, you know. And and I said to him, I said, you know, I didn't think about it like that. I never did. And here's my problem with it. Why me? Why me and not Tim, right? Why me and not someone's five-year-old who has cancer? And when you tell me that I only survived because of God's grace and other good people didn't, better people didn't, what you're telling me is that God is running a kind of random lottery for his grace. And I just happened, my number happened to win. And I don't want any part of a God that does that. And he didn't say anything after that. But that's my problem with this sort of like moralistic like interpretation of who lives and who dies. It's just, it completely fails.
Yeah.
Right. And when you think about it in those terms. But you know what did help, I'd say. So yes, I'm still an atheist. I would say I'm an atheist with a slightly more open mind than I was. And I'm not an agnostic. That to me is like a really kind of pathetic dodge. Like if someone said, do you believe in gravity? And I'm like, well, you know, I'm just sort of agnostic on that. Like, what do you mean you're agnostic on gravity? Like, you can't say that. Like, if you don't believe in gravity, you need to give me some reasons, but you can't say you don't have an opinion on it. Mm. And despite all the evidence of people jumping out of windows, you know, like, and falling to their death, right? So agnostic, I feel like, is a dodge. I'm an atheist. I do not believe in a God. But what I found in my research, I mean, there were a lot of very smart people who decided that these rather remarkable near-death experiences, of which there are thousands and thousands, and they're all quite similar in their narratives with a lot of commonalities, that this, they constitute not one, not two, but the aggregate, thousands of them, constitute a kind of evidence for a, what people like to call an afterlife. And as I was doing my research, of course, we're all scared of death, and I was reading these accounts. I'm like, damn, how do you explain this? Like, I felt myself sort of rooting for an afterlife, right? And to my slight embarrassment. And then I read the research by the sort of like naysayers, right? And these are other very rational, smart people. Like, no, you don't need the afterlife to explain this. We can explain it with, you know, neurochemicals and low blood oxygen and epileptic seizures and, you know, like the brain, the dying brain goes through all kinds of contortions, and this isn't a puzzle at all. And the sort of killjoys had me at the end. I'm like, all right, guess we'll have to give up on the afterlife idea. This all makes rational sense, except for one thing. And this is where I'm a little bit like in a kind of gray zone with it. I mean, first of all, some of the great physicists who pioneered quantum physics, the sort of the ultimate mystery of the subatomic world, a very, very smart, extremely rational men. A lot of them were sort of a little bit mystical, and Schrödinger in particular believed in a universal consciousness that occupied the entire universe, and that our individual consciousness was just a minute expression of this sort of colossus of consciousness that is the universe. And, you know, when someone like Schrödinger thinks something, like, it's sort of worth paying attention. So just sort of put that pin in the map for a moment. But then there's this other thing, which is that the dying, and I was one of them, the dying see the dead. And it's really, really common. You know, you give a room full of people LSD, we know that they will all have hallucinations. We know how that works within the brain. There's no mystery there. They do not all hallucinate the same thing. And what's odd about the dying is that they see the dead and no one else does. And this happens all the time with hospice nurses and in trauma bays and on the battlefield and what have you. And that is kind of, I don't quite understand the explanation for that. The neurochemical thing doesn't quite do it. It's the substance of the visions seems hard to explain. And there are many, many cases of dying people who saw someone who they didn't know was dead because the other person had just died. And they were surprised, like, whoa, Joe, what are you doing? Joe died in a car accident yesterday, and the dying person had no idea. And so there is a little, for me, there's a little bit of a little crack in the door of, you know what, maybe we just don't understand at the sort of quantum level the sort of ultimate mysteries of how the universe works, of what life is, what death is, what consciousness is. Maybe, as I say in my book, maybe we're looking at reality the way a dog looks at a television screen. The dog has no idea that there's a wider context that produces the visions that he's watching on the screen. Maybe that's what reality is for us, and we just cannot understand the connection between the screen that seems to wrap all around us and an even larger context which is producing what we're seeing. That, to me, is possible, and that there's a kind of universal consciousness that we know consciousness, conscious observation, completely determines reality at the quantum level, the subatomic level. We already know that consciousness affects reality in some extremely puzzling ways. I'm like, okay, that seems plausible scientifically. There is a kind of watery comfort to it. If, you know, I'm an atheist, but I can sort of get myself there intellectually.
Yeah. I mean, I've spent a little time reading about the transcultural phenomenon that we're calling a near-death experience. I mean, the first thing to point out from the side of the skeptic is none of these people actually died, right? I mean, no one has experienced brain death and then come back and said, yeah, the lights were still on, even though I had a zeroed-out EEG, right? I mean, that's just not what's happening. So people, there's still brain activity. And even if someone's heart has stopped, then they get restarted somehow, and they come back. And so, whatever the experience was, however, you know, interesting the implications of it, it is correlated with actual brain activity in terms of the person who comes back. So, I mean, some of these stories are spooky. There's no question. And then you have to wonder whether there is fraud or some, you know, kind of motivated distortions of memory. You know, because some of them overlap with claims of, you know, clairvoyance and other psychic phenomenon, right? Someone, you know, the person who rises up out of their body and they see something elsewhere in the room or elsewhere in the hospital that they couldn't possibly have seen if they had been stuck in their body, right? So you have this, you know, the was generally called psi phenomenon, which definitely would rattle our model of how the mind depends upon the brain, but it's not the same thing as being able to tell us what happens after death, because again, we're by definition talking about people who didn't die. So that's sort of the first, you know, foothold for the skeptic, even when you're, you know, no matter how spooky the story. But it is it's certainly interesting. I don't know if you don't spend a lot of time in the book talking about your research, but it is it's definitely interesting material. I've read some of the stuff you referenced there.
Yeah, and for me, I mean, of course, like, it's almost a definitional problem. Like, once you're dead, if you define death as brain death, that you, after some minutes, you can't recover from, if that's the definition of death, then yeah, there is no coming back from it. I mean, your heart stopping is nothing. You can get that thing going, you know, no problem.
Yeah.
So, yeah, can you resurrect someone who's been dead 10 years? No, you can't, right? They have, you know, if you could and could question them about what it felt like, well, that would be interesting, but that's not happening. So, but for me, if there is a mystery or a question mark at all around this, is that why do dying people have similar visions, right? Like, why did I see my dead father? Like, what is something going on there? And if it's a purely psychological phenomenon, like, why the consistency between many different people and many different cultures throughout history? Like, that's the only, and I'm not saying that proves anything. But it, for me, it does raise a legitimate question about what is this phenomenon. And, you know, one of the explanations for the visions of the dead are that there's some kind of cultural expectation, not true for me, right? That it's somehow a relief, like, oh, thank God, you know, I don't have to be scared that I'm dying because there's my daddy, you know, like, not true for me. And also, I didn't know I was dying, right? Like, I had no idea. So there was nothing, no reason to even project anything comforting because I thought I was in for belly pain. And I literally thought, I remember lying in the trauma bay thinking, there's a pretty good chance that tomorrow morning I'm going to wake up, whatever they're going to do with me, I'm going to wake up tomorrow morning and find out that I have a huge tumor in my abdomen and that I got 6 months to live. You know, I mean, I sort of was cogent enough to realize, like, this might turn out really badly. He'd absolutely no idea what's going down right now. So there, you know, to me, there are some real questions that don't have obvious, at least they don't have obvious answers.
Yeah, it's it is interesting to think, because the place it breaks apart for me, I mean, the fundamental mystery, which you, again, you discuss briefly in the book when you talk about the mind-body problem, what is genuinely mysterious from a scientific point of view still is how consciousness arises in the universe, or even whether it arises. I mean, it's possible that it goes all the way down and is a kind of a fundamental constituent of matter.
Right.
That's certainly not the majority opinion among scientists who study the mind, but you can't actually rule it out based on what we know about minds and brains yet. But what it seems like you can rule out, and this is where some of the accounts of NDEs seem easily deflated from the point of view of neuroscience, is that when you talk about the contents of consciousness, you know, just what it's like to be you in every personal way, your memories, your experience of, you know, perception moment to moment, just the way in which you are different from me phenomenologically. You know, why do you wake up with your memories and not my memories?
Right.
All of that seems fundamentally unmysterious now because of what we know about the brain. I mean, we know that if you damage a certain part of your brain, you won't be able to see. If you damage another part of your brain, you won't be able to understand spoken words, etc. And so what's strange about the general message people draw from NDEs, the death is something you survive, you know, the real you, the soul, it just lifts off the brain and goes elsewhere. What's strange about that picture is, well, we know that if we damage a little bit of your brain, you lose, you know, one faculty. If we damage a little bit more, you lose another faculty. And you basically can lose all of the faculties that would allow you to recognize, you know, your grandma or recognize your father and understand what they're saying to you and feel, you know, normal human emotions like gratitude and love. I mean, we know a lot about the neural correlates of all of those particular experiences. But the proposition seems to be, if you damage the brain in this piecemeal way, you lose all of these individual components. But if you damage the whole brain at death, i.e. die, well, then you rise off the brain intact and move as a soul that still speaks English and recognizes faces and feels love, and you go elsewhere. And that seems somehow deeply implausible. And yet consciousness, the fact that the lights are on at all, is still something we don't understand and certainly hasn't been reduced to any specific neurophysiological process at this point.
Yeah, I mean, this is where I totally agree with you. And I interviewed a wonderful researcher.
Christoph Koch, right?
Yeah. Who maybe you know. He has a book coming out just now about consciousness, which I haven't read. It sounds amazing.
Yeah.
So I, you know, because of my dad and whatever, I'm all in the camp of the the party pooper rationalists who are going to bum everybody out. You know, I totally get it. I mean, all I would say is that I can't understand why I had that vision. And I don't know why it's similar to so many other visions. And I wasn't culturally prepped for this, right? There was no anticipatory ideas of this was what will happen when I, and I didn't know I was, you know, I mean, so I just don't know what to do with that. And the only thing that provided for me a little bit of a possibility of a kind of rational explanation, I mean, religion didn't provide that, the sort of wishful thinking that you find in the NDE community certainly didn't provide that. And there's this, in that community, there's a lot of just totally blatant, like, proof of heaven, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like, just like, sorry, like, I'm not going there. But the one thing was, you know, I started, and I'm guessing you know something about this just because you seem like you know about an awful lot of interesting things. The sort of fundamental mystery at the subatomic level of how quantum phenomena work, that the observation of subatomic particles affects what they do, and that unobserved, they seem to be able to sort of do all things. And then once they're observed, they consolidate into one form, into one path. Like that's just a fundamental like puzzle for a macroscopic world that we live in. It doesn't seem to make sense. And as I say in the book, again, trying to be sort of both open-minded and skeptical at the same time, if you look at the sort of the nature of the universe we inhabit, It's 14 billion years old. It's 93 billion light years across. Of course, a light year is the distance that light travels in 1 year. And it went from nothing to hundreds of millions of light years across in an amount of time that's too small to measure, right? So in that context, my dead father hovering above me is sort of nothing, right? Like, I mean, if you, like, as far as stunts go, right, the universe itself is so staggeringly incomprehensible that when you get some of the smaller scale stunts of, like, dead fathers and such, well, all right, it may just be that all kinds of things are possible that, like a dog watching television, we just can't comprehend, because we cannot comprehend the very, very basic facts of physical existence. And the role of consciousness in that existence might be actually, instead of it being a sort of product of our biology, it may actually constitute part of matter the way gravity does, and the universe just wouldn't exist in the form it does without it, like it wouldn't without gravity. And it's, you know, I know it's a dodge because I'm ending with a question rather than an answer, but the question seemed legitimate after I did my research, trying to come make some kind of peace with what I experienced.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are interpretations of quantum mechanics that take consciousness out of the center of the picture, but it's at the cost of producing something else that is also extremely spooky, like the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, which many physicists at this point endorse. And it is, you know, I'm not a physicist, but it does seem on its face to be just about the most incredible picture of the universe anyone's ever heard, right? The idea that it's continually splitting into nearly identical copies of itself. And you and I are now having trillions upon trillions of nearly identical conversations, you know, in that just differ ever so slightly based on the way in which, you know, the quantum events have chosen their path here. And so it's not consciousness per se that's collapsing the wave function there. It's just that, like, everything that can happen does happen, you know, a functionally infinite number of times somewhere. But that's also just so bizarre. And thus far, we don't have an interpretation of quantum mechanics that conserves our apish intuitions about just, you know, what it's like to be in a world of rocks and waves and at the scale of a human hand, you know, and it's all very, very strange. I mean, I tend to emphasize the other side of it, which is just that in terms of our experience, which is really the place we always start, and we never leave. I mean, all of your knowledge of the world must first be encountered in consciousness as an experience and as an experience of various ideas and concepts. And so from that point of view, again, this is just the first person point of view, consciousness is the one thing in this universe that actually can't be an illusion, right? Like that, if you're certain of anything, it's of the fact that something seems to be happening where you are at this moment, right? And you could be totally confused about everything. You might be dead. This might be a dream. You might be a brain in a vat. But something seems to be happening, and that is the reality of consciousness.
That's right. And the many worlds theory, of course, I encountered that in my research, and it really kind of bummed me out because I had this ghastly thought that maybe my dream, where I died, was actually the experience of dying in another world. And I somehow split off from that and I'm now in this one. But there's some other world where my family thinks I left them.
Yeah, and there are millions upon millions of other worlds where you got hit by a car or you got shot with that bullet or you got, I mean, you...
Or I never met my wife and had a family, right? Yeah. I mean, I know I get it, but like in human terms, I like, oh my God, there's some other reality where they're grieving me. How do I make my way to them to say, hey, it's okay, because over here is another reality where we're still together, right? And I know this is all so irrational to be verging on a kind of schizophrenic thought process. I am aware of that, right? And, I had these thoughts without it totally determining how I experienced my life. But for a brief while, there was a real fear there. Like, I mean, I got to say, and I've been scared many times in my life, and this fear might have been actually the most profound. And it was the only anxiety, the only fear that really produced a pretty intense depression, you know, where I was actually frankly, kind of worried about myself. Only this did that.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that you've come out the other side of this and you have brought an amazing book with you. It was quite a thrilling and rewarding read. Again, I consumed it as an audiobook, which I highly recommend because you do a fantastic job of reading it. Before I let you go, Sebastian, what are you turning your attention to next? Do you have a project? Are you between projects? What are you thinking about?
I'm looking at book tour for a couple months and a little bit of a break this summer. And as my wife will tell you, I'm not very good at thinking ahead. So I have no idea what I'm doing next.
I like it. Well, I recommend you not take up tree trimming again. That didn't sound like it was going to maximize your time on Earth.
I actually still do that work.
You do? You do it all the way up with the chainsaw and
Wow. I do it for friends because it's expensive to have someone do it. And
Jesus.
But you know, the thing about it, as I say in my book, there's no random element. It's like chess, right? Yeah. If you lose a chess game, it's not because you rolled the wrong number on the dice or picked the wrong card. It's just because you made bad choices. And likewise with tree work, you're just dealing with physics, right? And you top out a big white pine at 100 feet and the top comes back on you, it's because you made the friggin' cut wrong. Like, so don't make the cut wrong. And that's the idea that we have agency over our fate, which we obviously don't in life. We do in the top, you know, 100 feet up in a tree with a running chainsaw. That's what I liked about it. It does talk about meaning and consequence. It does focus the mind, right? And that was sort of an intoxicating feeling.
All right. You're a little bit more like Alex Honnold than you've been letting on.
Yeah.
Nice.
Thank you so much for the conversation. I love that I stopped you in your hike.
Yeah.
I'll take that as a high compliment.
Yeah. I'm still alive, at least in this universe.
Yeah.
Best of luck on the rest of the tour, Sebastian.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed our conversation.